I hold in my hand a new book which comes out today, released today, so we celebrate the release with the author. License to Quill is a James Bond-esque spy thriller starring William Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe during history's real-life gunpowder plot. The story follows the fascinating golden age of English espionage, the tumultuous Cold War gripping post-Reformation Europe, and the cloak-and-dagger politics of Renaissance England. Readers will frequent the same taverns as Shakespeare, test their wits against the infamous Guy Fawkes, witness the miracles of the scientific revolution, and delight in the mysterious origins of the bard's most haunting play, Macbeth. Jacopo de la Quercia is an educator, a history writer, perhaps best known for his more than 100 articles on the comedy website Cracked.com. He also is responsible for the novel The Great American Lincoln Pocket Watch Conspiracy and its sequel, the book I mentioned, License to Quill. And it's a great pleasure to welcome to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. It's very nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me back.
First of all, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, it is Jacopo de la Quercia. If that's too much of a mouthful, you can just call me Giacomo or Jack.
Okay. Well, Jack is easier.
Well, you could call me you if it made things easier.
No, but now am I telling tales out of school? But that is your non-diplome.
Oh, what's in a name?
Yes.
Yeah, what it comes down to is when I was growing up, Giacomo, every time the substitute teacher would come to a name and pause, I would just say, that's me. So growing up, I had a sense of humor about it. And by the time I started writing creatively, I was doing some political work on the side. And some people who are much wiser than me said, you have to use a pseudonym. So I chose one that was A, very close to my own name, and B, was a nickname I'd been called by friends and family my entire adult life. So I was happy to use it. And also, Jacopo de la Quercia was a Sienese sculptor. So it's part of what I write about.
Okay. But it also doesn't solve the problem of the teacher going down the list and stopping.
No, it doesn't. In fact, some people might say it makes it worse. I mean, I look at it this way. Jacopo is easier for people to spell if they've heard it. And I've had people making fun of and screwing up my real name my whole life. I might as well give them a new name if they're going to be screwing that up as a writer.
I got you. All right. Well, if whatever works for you. Tell us about... Now, License to Quill, is this strictly a sequel to the last book?
I do view it as a sequel, even though it takes place several hundred years beforehand. And the way that I wrote it is that anybody who read its predecessor, The Great Abraham Lincoln Pocket Watch Conspiracy, they will see some surprise cameos in the book. And furthermore, if you haven't read The Great Abraham Lincoln Pocket Watch Conspiracy, I wrote this book to be the perfect introduction to it. Not simply chronologically, but because there's no spoilers, The Great Abraham Lincoln Pocket Watch Conspiracy opens in a London tavern. So this is a way of setting the stage for what happened hundreds of years before that tavern.
When it comes to this time period and wanting to write about the gunpowder plot, how did that all come to you in deciding that that's indeed what you wanted to do?
It's honestly an Albany connection. I was here in Albany shortly after I finished my manuscript for my first book. And on November the 6th, I went to my car and I had a little flyer on my windshield from Anonymous warning me that... they know everything, and of course, you know, we never forgive, we never forget. And Guy Fawkes' mask was on there. And at first I thought, did they know about the new book I was working on? But more specifically, when it comes to Gunpowder Plot, so many people have their mind of what Guy Fawkes was like, and his face has been put everywhere. And the truth is, that face is not real. It's as much a mask as the masks people put on with his image on it. So I try to use that familiarity and orientation with Guy Fawkes to create a bit of a disorientation with my dramatization of what he was really like, and also with my narrative of how he fits into this story.
So William Shakespeare, Christopher Marlowe, they're the characters that you use in this, in telling this tale.
Yes. When it came to the story, I wanted this to be a James Bond-esque spy thriller. Yeah. But as with my previous book, I was just looking for a time period where all these real events sort of coalesce together in history, almost like wheels on a clock. And when it came to Christopher Marlowe, he was a spy. And many scholars say his early death and his mysterious death was the greatest loss in the history of English literature. And his own story could have been its own spy story. But using that, using the coincidence of the gunpowder plot, or maybe not a coincidence of the gunpowder plot taking place while Shakespeare wrote Macbeth, and the real-life Cold War going on between the Protestants and the Catholics in England at the time, I just used all these events and all these characters, all these situations to turn into a Cold War-esque spy thriller starring William Shakespeare and Marlowe.
Now, Shakespeare, so, is a secret agent.
Yeah, well, the way that I wrote it is I tried to get some of the mysteries about William Shakespeare and tried to use those mysteries as my material for filling in the holes. And in the story, in real life, William Shakespeare did get himself in trouble with the English government more than once for his plays. And although I didn't know it, Shakespeare, either knowingly or unknowingly, played a role in a plot against Queen Elizabeth in the year 1601 during the Earl of Essex Rebellion. These rebels tried to stage a coup d'etat, and they hired William Shakespeare to perform one of his less popular plays for one night only with a censored scene included. He did that, and the next day there was nearly an uprising that killed Queen Elizabeth. So those were the materials that I brought from my research and from history into the story, and the real story was woven around that.
Why Macbeth? What is mysterious about the origins of that particular play and how that fits into this picture?
Well, I think that I'm not alone when I say there's something about Macbeth that has always stood out to so many people. I mean, naturally, Hamlet is probably the greater gift to the English language and to English literature. But Macbeth, there's just so many firsts with it. It's Shakespeare's only play set in Scotland. These three witches play such a mysterious role. The role of Macbeth and also Lady Macbeth is still so debatable who's responsible for it. And it just turned, I mean, it looked like I wasn't alone because coincidences would have it. We have a new James Bond film coming out and a new Macbeth film that I'm very much looking forward to.
One out, one coming out. So that's very interesting. So when you're writing it, the history is paramount for you? It's a tool in a toolbox? How do you look at it?
Maybe more like sand in a sandbox.
Okay.
In the sense where it's there and anybody has access to it. And when it came to writing this book, and with its predecessor, I just loved the opportunity to work with so many people who dedicated their whole lives to these stories and knowing the best tools to play with. I got to reconnect with an old friend of mine from Harvard, Ben Woodring. Hello, Ben, who helped me as I was researching this. There were people who dedicated their whole lives to these subjects, so many books. And even on YouTube, I got to follow diaries of people who cared for ravens. I got to see videos of a horse chiropractor on how to adjust a horse's spine. Probably don't try at home.
Right.
But it was just this wealth of research that was all around us that I not only fell in love with, but just formed the basis for so many elements of the story. And just as I found it interesting and I provide the sources, I believe that readers will find it interesting as well.
So at what point do you think to yourself, oh, I need to talk to a horse chiropractor? Because obviously they weren't around at that time.
Well, fortunately, we live very close to Saratoga, and I did call up some of the stables there. They were the first people who I went to, and I was looking for the Aston Martin of horses. That's how I described it. So just as James Bond has an incredible car, Shakespeare in the story has the world's greatest horse. But more than that, I wanted to find some research in terms of were there any famous horses in history during this time. I found out that there were, and there was this incredible bloodline of horse called the Turcoman, which is now extinct, which was the predecessor to the thoroughbred bloodline. So it was all this history on husbandry that I was able to add into the story as well. And it's very funny because I saw similarities to how some people today might have an enormous garage filled with cars. Back then, it was the same thing, only their cars had hearts and had emotions.
A stable of horses.
Exactly.
When you're in something like this, I don't want to take away the work aspect to it. I know it's a lot of hard work, but it also seems like it is play.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very entertaining. And furthermore, I got to have so much fun with how am I going to tell the story? Because everybody has their opinion of what Shakespeare is like. It's the challenge I had writing about Abraham Lincoln. Everyone, including little children, have their thoughts of what Lincoln is like. And I found myself in a situation similar to how I heard Hitchcock described when he was directing Cary Grant. I got this famous celebrity, and I got to torture him. I got to take him out of his element. I got to drop him off in the wilderness. I got to cover him with ink and have him without sleep. And it is fun to be able to do that, and it's also experimental. It's like a chemical laboratory. I have all these elements. I know how they work, and I try to see which of them are most explosive if I add them together.
So do you think about what's next, or do you...
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
The ink isn't dry, so I can't give too much details.
Well, that's all
right. But I must say, I had so much fun researching the villainesses in this story that I had all this material with me that I wanted to continue writing about. And I do end this book saying that something very big is going to happen. For my next book, which I am looking forward to, and which will hopefully be my first co-authored project, we're going to see what that big thing was.
And it will be something that is at least somehow related to the other two works.
Oh, they're all connected. I mean, as long as people are willing to read these, as long as teachers are willing to use them in classrooms, as long as people are looking for books that might make good movies, I would like to write these books for the rest of my life.
How do teachers use them in the classroom?
Well, really, I wrote these books to serve as a lightning rod for getting students as well as teachers excited about these materials. These are the kind of books that I wish I read as a teenager, because it doesn't treat Abraham Lincoln as a marble statue. It doesn't treat William Shakespeare as a woodcut. I try to show them as real people, and we learn so much about them. We learn where they ate, how Shakespeare wrote his plays, who Shakespeare plagiarized from, and the world that he lived in, which really was like its own Orwellian government state. It's a fascinating history that I wish I learned about, but hopefully teachers will use this book and its predecessor in the classroom so students learn that.
The new novel is out today. It is License to Quill. It is published by St. Martin's Griffin, and it is it's a lot of fun and an awful really enjoyable to read and a page-turner. So that's all good things. You can, again, find it. It's out today. Jacopo de la Quercia, thank you very much for being with us. It's great to have you on the program again. Thank you very much for the lovely treats that you brought in. That was very nice of you.
A pleasure, care of Crichon Bakery on Lark Street.
Yes, which are wonderful friends, and we thank you very much for doing that. And best of luck with the book.
Thank you, and happy holidays.
And to you. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.